Broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Learning Insights, featuring learning professionals improving performance to drive business results.
Welcome to another exciting and informative edition of Learning Insights. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Stone. How are things going in your world?
Going really well. I've had a good time. You know, the American Society of Association Executives threw me a little birthday party last
night.
That's
right. It was very nice of them. We had a few, 500 people or so. Had you on the big screen a couple times.
That was a lot of fun.
Quite an event.
They're doing. But today's show is all about learning. And speaking of learning, my youngest started school again today. She's going to Pope. She's going to be a junior this year.
And you got one in college?
Got one in college.
A lot of learning going on in the Payton household.
Yeah, I moved her in last week. Now, does Max get started this week? Or?
No, he does not. He's still vacationing.
So today's segment is all about learning, and it's about impact of learning, return on investment, evaluation, and a little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Jack Phillips with ROI Institute, and we're going to talk with Melanie Hudson with EBS Healthcare. But first up on Learning Insights this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from Kirkpatrick Partners, Mr. Jim Kirkpatrick. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, Stone.
So we are delighted to have you. As most of our listeners know, my wife has a real job, and it's in the learning arena. So I'm not completely unfamiliar with your name or your work. You're a little bit of a celebrity in this space. You've been talking about, writing about ROI for some time now, haven't you?
Well, absolutely. And look at a Jack here across the way. Interesting. His concept is more ROI. Ours is more ROE, but we're in the same, you know, the same field. But I have been doing it. Basically took the torch from my father, Don Kirkpatrick, who developed four levels of evaluation back in the 1950s. And over the last 15 years or so, we've been kind of tweaking and supercharging it and supersizing it. We now call it the New World Four Levels. So it's about evaluating training programs and creating more value to the business.
Can you talk a little bit about how it's evolved over the years?
Well, it stayed pretty static for about five decades.
And then you got involved, right?
Yeah, a lot
then
of...
Then you shook things up and got this thing on track.
Well, there were a lot of bad habits and a lot of things that the industry had kind of operationalized that really were not what my father's intent were, mm-hmm. as far as starting with level one, starting with training, and we just realized long ago that we need to start with a business, not with training.
And so can you talk about that? So once you made that determination, then what happened?
Well, we've been trying to get people to break bad habits is really what we've been trying to do for the last 10, 15 years. And a lot of that has to do with making sure you start with what the business is expecting from a training initiative rather than throwing something out there and hoping that somehow it creates some value that's going to be meaningful to business people. And it's we've been trying to educate people and certify people, starting with the end in mind and making sure that everything happens, everything that does happen in the world of training and performance is designed to make a specific impact on the business, the mission, the vision, whatever of the organization.
So doesn't this rely a great deal on executive support? And if so, how do you go about getting that as a training or learning professional?
Well, one of the concepts that we talk about is we want to try and avoid having executives sign off on initiatives, because what they do then is they sign off on it, they sign a check, they put their feet up on the desk, and they hope that somehow training is going to deliver the power and the magic.
So they think they're done. When the check is signed, then
they're and it just doesn't work that way. And we're trying to break the myth that the training event is powerful enough to create those kind of results. So we try and get them to sign on as far as being involved with accountability and support and being an active champion, rather than just waiting for the magic at the end.
And then when you align the training and you kind of integrate it into their culture, then it has a higher probability of succeeding?
Absolutely. We're really heavy on making sure that the training is leveraged into performance, because if performance doesn't change, if behaviors don't change, there's really no hope that the results are going to happen. And then, of course, the answer is send everybody back to training.
Right. And, job security, I like it.
And yet that... If people are really into designing training events, we think it's only a matter of time before they're replaced by YouTube you know, because that's a lot cheaper if people are only dumping content right. on their trainees. So we're really trying to create what we call a package or a formula for learning and performance rather than kind of focusing on events.
Now, these four levels, it's four levels, right, or is it five?
It's four.
Maybe you need a fifth, you know?
Well, you'll be hearing about
maybe
that
next
in a few
year.
Minutes.
Next year, we'll come back and we'll have level five. All right, so these four levels, though, they're still timeless. There's still plenty of merit in the levels themselves. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
That still makes plenty of sense. So what is the focus now? Is it trying to get learning professionals to do a better job at getting at each of the levels, or having them focus on some levels more than others, or speak to that some?
Well, there seems to have been a five-decade love affair with levels one and two, which are reaction to training and learning. And we talk about learning organizations and learning function and learning objectives. We're trying to get people to move beyond that into the behavior, into the performance, into the results. And they have to completely change their mindset of who they are as learning professionals or training professionals, and trying to emphasize more building a package that includes support and accountability at level three, which is behavior, which will then lead to level four. But there is still such a lobby and such a belief that once you deliver training, or once you have created learning, your job is done. And it just isn't.
Now, do you find that companies are more, the CEO or some leader reads an article in Inc. magazine about some new technique, and they're like, yeah, this will work for us. And then it's like kind of a patch they're putting on it. It's not really, it may not work in their culture. There could be a million reasons not to do it, but it's like the flavor of the month.
It is, and it's tempting, and it's really alluring that, oh, if we can just do this new thing. A guy in Best Buy called it lipstick on a pig. You called it a patch. You know, it's just trying to doll up these training events to make them look better, and with the allure that they're going to bring value, and they don't. It's got to be through the hard work of discipline, accountability, the right kind of support in the culture that's going to make the difference, and that's a harder sell than the patchwork is.
Because it would seem to me that the you lose the trust of the employee, you know, because if you're changing every 6 months, 12 months to a new silver bullet that's going to solve some problem, at some point, don't the employees just tune all this out and think that, look, last month you told me to do it this way, and now you're telling me to do it this way. You know, why should I believe anything you say?
So they just wait it out. And,
right.
You know, and the trainers go in and promise all these things. Oh,
and everybody
you'll be
nods their head, and they're all rah-rah excited to go. And then 3 months later, they're back to their old habits.
That's right. And all they have to do is wait it out. And we're trying to, as best we can, create the belief that it's going to take we call it a business partnership approach, that everybody has to work together versus the solution rather than
right. It sounds more holistic, that it's like you're trying to get right into the DNA. You're not just kind of superficially trying to attack this.
Exactly. Yep.
So let's go to the work itself, and I think you mentioned earlier in the conversation you're certifying people to execute on this work. Is that accurate?
That's right.
All right, so let's say Business Radio X, a growing concern with a lot of training needs. We've developed some systems and processes that seem to be working, and one of your people comes in. Describe the work. Are we sitting down and maybe having level four discussions before we start trying to design training? Or just walk us through that engagement, if you would.
Yeah, you've got a good idea there. That's exactly what we do, is we start with the level four discussions rather than trying to say, here's a program that you should go through. You know, we don't want to be part of the problem. We want to be part of the solution and mm-hmm. model the solution. So we talk about what is it you're trying to do with your organization or your business. You know, what will be the criteria for success? And then from there, we talk about what will be the pathway to get there.
And you're participating in this conference, this ACE conference. ASTD, Conference and Exposition? You're participating in that this week. And you're speaking?
Yes.
And you've already done that, or you're going to go do that later?
Later.
This is the warm-up. See,
this is the warm-up. We're trying to get people excited about it.
So can you give us a sneak peek? Share some of
yeah.
what you're talking about?
Well, I'm going to be doing one of the keynote addresses and talking about starting with the end in mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, the results and how to do that, and especially how to have conversations with senior stakeholders to let them know that a certain level of effort is going to be required to accomplish their objectives. And it's a difficult conversation, but we're going to try and teach people how to be truthful with them about that, the level of effort. And then also talk about how to establish a support plan after training to make sure that, that people that have learned something, those people that you're talking about, rather than going back and fending for themselves, there's somebody or something, some process waiting to help them be successful. And then also how to streamline levels one and two. Stone, as you were talking about, what levels are we trying to focus on?
Yeah.
How to streamline level one and two so they can redeploy their resources to levels three and level four, especially for mission-critical programs.
Now, when you're talking to the stakeholders about this and you're telling them that not only do they have to write you a check, but they're going to have to do work too, how do those conversations go? How do you move them off that the premise of maybe the history that they've had where they're like, look, that's your problem. I wrote the check here. You figure this out.
You know what?
That never happens, I'm sure, right?
What we usually find has to happen, we work with government and military and
yeah, so there's no bureaucracy there. So it's probably easy.
Well, okay, well, great, thanks. All right, on to the next group. What we usually find is that we have to create a success story within their organization and find one or two pilot programs with what we call bright lights that are business leaders on the other side that are willing to try this and pilot a program on leadership or customer service or something, create success, and then showcase that to the skeptics, the naysayers, and people that really aren't aware. But you can show them all the research and give them all the best guidance, but they almost always have to see something that worked in their organization before they're going to start to buy into
it. So then you have to just get them to agree to a pilot.
That's
it.
To
say, okay, yep, let's test it, and then how does that test come about? Like, who picks the test subject? Typically.
Yeah. Well, that's where we start with the learning people, and then we find out who on the other side of the bridge do you have a good relationship with.
So you're starting with an easy one. You're not going to the that's worst case scenario, right?
That's what we do. For instance, we work with Emirates Airlines in Dubai, and they identified a group that handles the call center and the reservations. And they said, Paul Beach over there is a bright light. He's at least willing to give us a shot. Let's pilot it with him and then have him and his team be the witness to the other people in the organization to tell them this will work. When learning comes calling, give them a chance.
Now, when you do that, do you get agreement from the stakeholder that says, look, if I can pull this off with this guy, then you're going to deploy this across the board, or you do this kind of one step at a time?
You know, sometimes that works. When we say, all right, give us a couple pilots, we'll show you the power of this without extra resources, because we're trying to redeploy resources out of this silliness into all the event training and stuff and redeploying them so we can show maximum results on the same resources. They said, if we show you that, will you be willing to deploy this further? And they say yes.
So you cost us the YouTube sponsorship a little earlier in the conversation, but you have some concerns about YouTube, right?
No, I think the electronic technology is great, but we have to be careful that it doesn't replace our industry. And if training continues to believe that they are about disseminating content,
like a commodity. It can't be a commodity, right?
Yep, they're standing at the edge of the plank ready to walk off.
They just don't know it yet.
Well, we're trying to clue them in a little bit. At least, and this isn't just us thinking this stuff up. These are Kirkpatrick ambassadors around the world that we work with and that are we use them to tell our story.
Right. Can you share maybe a success story where a company was having a problem and you were able to deploy this and then you were able to make a significant change and difference?
No.
Well, our next guest maybe.
I'm kidding. One example would be with the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh, wow. High fives for that.
We said, we'll help you as long as you don't audit us. They said, well, we can't promise that. But one guy was given a chance in a particular division to show this and implement this mm-hmm. area. And after actually a lot of battling, because the legacy in the IRS was training oriented, and he was using a business partnership approach. And after battling the criticism, finally the deputy commissioner said, you know what, we need to do this across the house. So now they're in the midst of implementing this business partnership approach, end in mind, making sure things work rather than the training event approach.
Now, how did you measure success? Like, what were the metrics that proved that this was working?
Well, in the IRS, they have three what we call flags at the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. One is generating revenue, you know, from those who are supposed to be paying.
Right.
Two would be customer satisfaction, people feeling like they are treated positively and with respect.
Right.
And third would be the employee satisfaction. Same thing. People believing that they are making a contribution, making a difference, and we had metrics for all those things. And
did you tell them I'll only do the bottom two and the first one you're on your own?
Well, it's interesting. We kind of, as this unfolded, they kind of, through this business partnership approach, made the customers more satisfied, the employees more satisfied, and the revenue generation was almost a kind of a byproduct.
Right.
Of that.
And that's, I bet that happens a lot.
It does. And we look at this business partnership approach as almost always collateral benefit because people feel cared for. They feel that they're not on their own waiting right. for the next event. And they also are making a contribution that as individuals they can see. This is not just corporate return on expectations. This is individuals being able to see that they're making a difference to the greater good
right.
of the organization.
And I would imagine in the IRS that, you know, I wouldn't think that a lot of IRS people are proud to tell their friends and family, hey, I work for the IRS.
They don't
and,
lead
you
with know, that at the cocktail party.
Right, you know, so if you can increase their dignity, it probably goes a long way.
Absolutely.
So you spoke earlier about streamlining the levels 1 and 2, and then we spent some time talking about levels 3 and 4. Speak to the backside, the post-training, the coaching, the reinforcement, the support. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I wrote a book a few years ago called Transferring Learning to Behavior because I was just – it was kind of in a fit of how upset I was that learning is the holy grail. So I thought, well, at least we'll put something out there as others have been trying to do, talking about behavior. So in it, we talk about two distinct forces, one of support, which is kind of encouraging people to apply what they learned, and the other is accountability, where you're kind of monitoring. It's kind of more the stick and the carrot. So we talk about – ahead of time, as you're building an initiative, you don't just build the training event. You're building the support and accountability package. You get agreement on that, and then you start to monitor those things once people graduate from training, ensuring that those things are happening. You have dashboards, scorecards, and if things start to go south of the standards, you have already put in place. The leader is going to then challenge and say, hey, we're not holding people accountable enough. We're not encouraging enough. We're not reinforcing enough. Making sure that we ask and answer the question, is it working along the way to then lead to did it work?
Right, because isn't compliance, that's kind of the holy grail. You want everybody to be compliant, and you have to know going in that people are going to kind of slip up, right? You have to build mechanisms to catch the people when they slip up. And it's good for the person to know that, hey, something's going to be there. I know eventually I'm going to mess up, and someone's going to be there to kind of nudge me back in.
Are you speaking from experience or just hypothetically? You know what? And we cannot teach everybody in training. I don't care how good the training is. Everything that is going to happen on the job, there needs to be somebody or something there when they say, I'm stuck, or I forgot, mm-hmm. you know, or I've been thrown something, somebody or something's got to be there to show them immediately when they need it, how to apply it,
right.
and how to handle the situation.
So when you build your machine, that's built into the process, right?
Yep.
All right, so let's get some real-world counsel here, because here's what I can see happens. My training manager meets with you or one of your certified folks, and they get fired up. They resonate with all this. It makes perfect sense. They buy the books. They get all studied up. Then they come to Lee and I as executive sponsors and owners of this business, and we're well-meaning. We think we're doing the right thing. We think that we have good discernment, good judgment, but there are some things that Lee and I are probably apt to do that could just shoot this thing right in the hind end. What are some things that we...
It's him more than me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure.
But what are some mistakes that we as executives might make that could shut this whole thing down? And or conversely, what are some things that we could do that could really give this thing a real shot?
Well, some of the mistakes are to not do what you agreed to do ahead of time. Because we want to make sure we create some kind of learning and performance agreement that you agree that you're going to monitor people's balanced scorecards or you're going to do some informal
recognition.
So follow
through.
That's it. That's pretty much it. And I'm telling you, if we could get you two, you know, as executives to model the way, others start to pick up on it and you start to create a culture change. And this Kirkpatrick Four Levels is no longer a course by course kind of thing is right. where my dad invented it, is really trying to change a culture to one of learning and performance, accountability, support. And we have different certification programs we call bronze and silver and gold that really carry not only the training people but the business people through the process, holding each other accountable with other people from other companies, just like you guys, as we have, you know, phone calls on a regular basis and webinars to do what we can to ensure that you guys do what you agreed to do.
What a delight having you come in the studio and visit with us this morning. We got to give a shout out to our good buddies over at Training Pros. They're always bringing us competent, passionate folks that are making a real difference in the world. And man, I'm so glad you came. You got to come back sometime. You got plenty to talk about, don't you?
I got a few more things. Yeah, give me a call. I enjoy this. And you know what? You guys are making it easy by asking the right questions and poking the right things. And I appreciate it.
Well, we're delighted to do it. But before we wrap this segment, let's make sure that our listeners know how to reach out, maybe get their hands on the book that you mentioned, and where they can reach out to talk with someone and have a meaningful conversation about these four levels in this new world.
Well, there's the first question you caught me on. I wish my wife was here. She'd say, Jim, don't you know our phone number? No, I do know that it's information@kirkpatrickpartners.com. And for lack of my memory of what our official phone numbers are, the best local one here is 770-683-2846. And we are real people. This is a real model, and we're glad to answer any questions people
have. And your website is kirkpatrickpartners.com.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Good research, Lee.
Watching That's your right. back.
The, okay, I appreciate you
know?
It.
He at least stays up all night and researches these interviews, as I'm sure
Does
you
he?
Can see. Hey, listen, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Glad to.
All right. And we're going to leave your microphone open because we're going to circle back in a little while and have more conversation. All right. Next up on Learning Insights, we have back with us Lee, no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone. Please join me in welcoming to the show Dr. Jack Phillips. How you doing, man?
Hey, Stone. I'm glad to be here.
Fine. We are delighted to have you. You look like you were engaged in that conversation and enjoying it, but you have a great deal to say about return on investment from training as well. Tell us, if you will, just to get started, just general overview of your practice. How did you get started, and what are you out there trying to do for folks?
Okay, good. Well, I was connecting quite clearly with what Jim was saying there, because I think he's right with all those issues. We take it a little bit further than Jim does, as we'll talk about. My work goes back to the 70s when I was asked by a senior executive at Lockheed, just down the road here, to show the value of a cooperative education program where we had co-op students alternating work and school. And this particular executive wanted to see the impact and the ROI of that program to see if we should continue it. That got me into a very a deeper analysis than we typically see around learning. And from that study, we saw some interesting things. As we did the study, we noticed and we presented the results that, yes, we had a positive ROI, and that actually kept the funding for the program. And we didn't know for sure until that comment came that we will keep this program, that we really were that close to having it cut away. So keeping the funding is a critical issue. But more importantly, from that meeting, I developed a relationship with some senior executives that I needed to work with going forward. And we actually made some improvements in the program. That is, we made it a better program. So I'd like to think that building relationships with key executives, improving your programs, building support for learning is just as important, if not more important, than funding for the learning. But these days, with the recession, funding is an issue. So we took that experience, began to work more detail. We added a fifth level to the levels, and we changed them just a little bit. We have reaction, learning, application, impact, and ROI, the ROI being the fifth level. We wrote the first book about training evaluation in the USA in 1983, detailing it and with a lot of good, clear examples. And then 20 years ago, in 1992, we founded this institute to bring it to the world. We work globally now in 60 countries through our partners, and we have 60 books that support our process and methodology. It's the most used evaluation system in the world, so we're very pleased to be here with you. That gives you a quick summary.
Yeah, it does. And we all know Dr. Patty is the brains behind the outfit.
She is.
No, she's a very big part of this operation,
she
right?
Is. She is. She's the CEO of the company. She's the smartest person. So her books are more interesting. They win more awards. She's a lot more attractive than I am. You get the picture. I don't know why you don't have her here and not me.
It was something about standards was in the correspondence. Yeah. Apparently she has them.
She does.
No, that's fantastic. So so tell us more about the day-to-day. You have people out on the street working inside organizations, helping them do this, and or you're ordaining, certifying people inside organizations to do
yes.
this stuff?
Yes. We actually transfer this capability to others, much like Jim does in his system. But it's a little more comprehensive. We have a 5-day certification that we started in 1995. And we teach them how to do this. But they don't become certified until they actually conduct a study that meets our standards of our process, and it goes to the ROI level. To date, we've had 3,500 people reach that level, 3,500 certified ROI professionals from our institute. But we've had 7,000 plus, probably close to 7,500, that have actually gone through that process. This week at UPS, at the headquarters, we're having a group of 20 people going through the same process. 5 days of training. All of those people will go and work on their projects. Not everyone does that. Not everyone finishes it, but most will, over 50%, to become a certified ROI professional. But in addition to that, those cadre of people who are using this methodology, we have our own consultants and our own associates. Associates in the USA, about 25 of them. But most of our work is outside the USA. If you look at the revenue of
really?
Our institute.
That surprises. Does that surprise you at all, Lee?
60%+ of our revenue is coming from outside the USA through partners representing 60 countries. We have 35 partners. We spend most of our time. I visit 30 countries at least every year, and Patty about 25, working with our partners in these different countries.
So now when you initially came up with this concept of ROI, was it something so prior to this they weren't caring about ROI?
Well, not in the learning space.
How are they judging success?
Just by faith, probably.
Faith?
Yes.
The best salesperson as a learning professional was the one that was judged the best, right?
I think Jim would agree that we've approached learning in the past to saying, look, you need this. We have to have learning to grow. So let's put the programs out there. Maybe it'll work, maybe it not. Let's invest on faith. It's a faith-based initiative.
Is that does it transfer to, like, kids? Or is this only works for adults where you can have an ROI?
It's not working very well.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think we're still keeping up with this faith-based learning.
So what's happened is that you can see executives have been using the concept of ROI for many years, goes back 200 years, for capital expenditures like buildings and tools and equipment. But in the last 20 years plus, this concept of ROI has moved to the non-capital investments. Non-capital would be human resources and learning and development, but also marketing, quality, and even some technology. So with the help of the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, we have seen this huge shift in pushing ROI for these other areas. Marketing is a good example of that. They're having to deliver a marketing ROI. And the ROI calculation must follow the classic, typical formula for an ROI out of the finance and accounting. In fact, the finance and accounting team have to be a part of it these days, and they are a part of it. We see an important trend from the Gartner research is that more chief human resource officers, for example, the head of HR, reporting over to the chief financial officer, which is a huge shift. 6 years now, they've reported more and more of these are occurring. Now, still not many. You know, we're talking 15 to 20% max, depending on the country. But what that tells us is that this is such a huge expenditure in human resources, is that no longer can they just sit there and invest in faith. They've got to have something more than that. And they love ROI, particularly the CFO. They live and breathe on the ROI.
Now, isn't there a trap, though? Just because something can be measured doesn't mean it's the right thing that you're measuring. You know, the CFOs and accountants love to count things and put things in graphs and charts. But just because it easily can fit in there, can you really say that that's really the key driver, key metric that you're trying to achieve at the end of the day?
Yes, yeah, so with a couple of issues here. One is just as Jim suggested, we start with the end in mind with a clearly defined impact measure that we want to improve. You've got to do that. And we do that with a classic V model that we created, published in ASTD in 1994. The V model is a way to frame your initial needs assessment at five levels, and they match five levels of objectives and the five levels of evaluation. So that V model is the beginning of the process so that we make sure we have the right measure. That's the first issue. The second issue, there's some measures out there that we cannot convert to money, and we know that, or at least not easily. And that's often teamwork and communication, cooperation, maybe even stress, maybe even customer satisfaction, job engagement, brand, reputation, image, and so forth. Now, some organizations, even some in the city, have actually put monetary value on most of those. And that's the good news, is we're seeing more and more what are classic intangibles converted to money. If it converts to money, it goes in the ROI calculation, but only if it's credible. But it usually takes too much effort if they haven't done it already. So we say, hey, look at that as a sixth type of data. So we've got five levels plus another type. It's the intangibles that are not in the ROI calculation. But then the third issue, I'd say, probably in the question, is, look, most of what we do should not be subjected to the ROI analysis. And our best practice framework is that maybe 5% of your programs really deserve this kind of analysis. And those are the programs that are most expensive, they're more strategic, they're more important. They're designed to deliver value, and they track the executive attention. That's when you need to push it up to the ROI level, which means that most should not go to that level. So I'd say still most of our learning and training should probably stop at level one and two. But as Jim suggests, I think we've got to get more at level three. We suggest 30% as a rule, 30% of your program push to that level of analysis. We suggest 10% pushed to the impact analysis, which means that we would separate the impact of the learning from other influences. And then only 5%, half of those, would go to the ROI. That's best practice, and that mirrors what we're seeing in a best practice use from our organizations.
So on those items that can be converted to money, is there a rule of thumb across the board that you should expect X percent of return, or does that vary a great deal from industry to industry and company to company, and it's just more important that they figure out what they feel like they've got to get?
It varies tremendously. But now, what you want to look at is your objective. We set objectives at each level for level 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. At level 5, that's the ROI, so we set an ROI objective. And then when you calculate ROI, you compare it back to your objectives. That corresponds to the return on expectation that Jim's talking about. The objective is set with the stakeholders at each of the levels to define what we should achieve at that level. Now, for your ROI, it's usually four strategies that are used to set that objective. One is to use the same ROI that you would use as a target for capital expenditures, such as a building or new equipment or tools. And these days, that's about 12 to 18%. We could use that as the objective. Some want to do that. We were with ExxonMobil, a chemical company in the Netherlands just recently, and that's what they're putting out for all of their learning and development program. In Honeywell, we did the same with them internally. They're doing the same thing. So you might use that one. Another one is to set it a little bit higher. That is, we know what we're doing is not familiar to a lot of people, and executives aren't used to seeing this, so we put a little higher standard, maybe 20 or 25%. Then others would say, and I would agree, that sometimes a zero ROI is okay. Zero ROI means that we recovered the cost of our learning. And I think Jim would agree, if we can generate enough monetary value to cover the cost of the learning, most executives would be happy because we still got those intangibles, not in that calculation. But zero ROI seems to be inferior. You can imagine, we got an ambitious goal here of zero ROI for this program. It sounds like Bart Simpson. So then we lead to another one, and it's very much like what Jim would do with his ROE, and that is let the client set the expectation. Let them set the objective. We have to be careful they don't set it too high. We may have to remind them, hey, you will buy equipment. For example, I'm working with IM Gold Corporation, a mining company in Toronto, and they set a 30% ROI objective for a leadership development program involving 1,000 of their first-level managers. the HR executive says, so we will buy equipment here for 11% ROI. Why would you want to have 30% for this program? Isn't that unfair to us? And she argued, both the HR executive and the chief financial officer are females in that organization, which is unusual for the mining industry. But the CFO says, look, when we buy equipment for 11% is our target, we know we'll get that because we follow up and see. We haven't seen this with leadership development, so I'm going to put a little higher standard.
But in these cases, it sounds like an arbitrary number. And then once you have that, then you have some sort of a benchmark that you can move forward with going forward. Isn't that right?
Well, you said it's arbitrary in a sense, but it's an objective. It's what we would like to have. Now, if you look at what determines the ROI for our capital expenditure, it's related to the cost of capital typically. And if we can get more investing in stocks and bonds instead of buying this equipment, we'd probably just shut our business down and do that.
Right.
So we often set it a little higher than that. So there's some basic targets that we use or anchors that we use to set that number. But yes, it's a minimal acceptable performance. We don't like to go into a study, a project, without the ROI objective because when you get done, you may be asked by an executive, so what was your objective? You know, if you come out with 38%, you could easily say, well, our objective was only 10. But if you came out to -5, you could easily say, well, that was our objective. So you don't want to play games with this. We want to set an acceptable target, minimum acceptable with the stakeholders involved, getting their input as well. So, yes, it's arbitrary in a way, but it's based on some tradition of what we can accomplish and what we should be accomplishing by investing this kind of money.
So who in organizations is making the decision to engage you and your army of folks? Is it more and more the executive, or is it learning professionals or some kind of blend? It
sounds like the CFO is your best friend.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we don't call on the CFO and the CEO directly, but we see, I'd say probably half of our engagements are influenced by that group. They're putting pressure on the learning function to show more than they've done before.
Mm-hmm.
They want a more rigorous maybe impact analysis, and they want even ROI for many of their projects. So they're driving that. But we also see some learning leaders that are being more proactive. They're not waiting for that request, but they're actually pushing it. They're pushing it before it comes, and they want to be in control of the agenda. Because if you wait for an executive to ask you for this, then you're on the executive timeline, you're on their agenda. And by the way, that timeline is going to be very short. And I don't want to be on their agenda. And I really want the luxury of doing it myself in my way. And maybe learning a few things along the way before I even pop that up to their executives.
So this is a little bit of a more selfish question, but then again, it is my show. So I want to learn more about your decision to go international. We have some designs here at Business Radio X. We feel like what we do here should play equally as well in the UK and France and in Italy. What compelled you to make the decision, and what are some major lessons that you learned where you might save us some heartache?
Okay. Well, first, we knew that we're only a small part of the world here. We get the impression sometimes that we're king of the world, but we're not. We're 300 million people in a 7 billion population world. So we're small. Also, many of the multinationals that we work with in the USA have huge operations, and some of our companies here, most of their operations are outside the USA. So we want to really work with them and engage them as well. And so we said, we know we'll get the USA market. But let's go after the other market. So our very first project was in Johannesburg, South Africa. The second project was in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And the third project was in Canada. So purposely, we went after that market. We did this also with the help of ASTD. ASTD has endorsed this methodology, and they helped us build this network of people who are using this process over a period of years. Now, what's happened is that when we work with companies outside the USA, it may be the IBM branch in Singapore. And so what that would do is get us into the IBM headquarters in Armonk, New York, when we were not there already. So it really helped in that sense. But it also made it easy when we're working in multinational companies that when we work with headquarters here, that we say, we already got your Australia and your South Africa network on board. So it really helped us from blending out our process into the different areas and different countries.
All right, Lee, we're going to get serious about going across the pond.
You should do it.
We should do it, right?
And it's the starting with people you have a relationship with, and it kind of organically grow from there.
Yeah. In our case, we wrote this book, as I mentioned, the first book of training evaluation in the USA in 1983. It became a good-selling book. It's now going into its fourth edition, celebrating its 30th year in publication. That book caught a lot of interest. Again, it was at a time when there's nothing out on evaluation at that time in terms of a book form. Don wrote his first book in 1994, The Four Levels. So he didn't have a book out there in terms of how do you do it in some detail. So it caught on globally. So our international business grew by invites. Come and work with us was our first visit in Johannesburg. It was a company called Eskom, the large electric utility there. It's a company that we still work with, and we'll be working with them next March when we visit them. The next one is the Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Again, invite based on the book that we have.
So you've got to write a book.
Got to write a book. That's
maybe you can write a book for us, Jack.
Does that work? We can help you. We know how to do that. We've got lots of books. Too many books, probably.
Now, you're on the dais at this ACE thing this week as well. What's going to be the focus of your talk?
Yes, I'll be doing the opening keynote, and I want to set the stage in terms of let's look at the various stakeholders involved, and particularly the executives, and what's the executive view. And so we have a study that we did with the ASTD's sponsorship showing what executives want to see from the learning investments and what we're actually providing to them. Some very startling results. For example, at level 3, 61% of those executives want to see level 3 data, the application of behavior, yet only 11% of them have this data. At level 4 impact, 96% want to see the impact, but only 8% are getting it now. ROI, 74% want to see ROI, only 4% are seeing it now. Those are huge gaps. Gaps that I think Jim and I both are working on with our teams to try to close. They are critical issues. If we don't close those gaps, we are going to lose more influence. We're going to lose budgets. And so that's our goal. Look, they're supporting us because they see learning as a critical issue. They see learning as necessary. But they get frustrated when they don't see the results that they appreciate. So we're going to start with that description, but also show as you adopt a measurement system, make sure it meets the executive scrutiny of credibility. You cannot put something in front of them and get them to buy into it if they don't believe in what you're doing. They don't understand it very well. And one of the issues that we always address is that we sort out the effect of learning from other influences. We know that learning is always complementary with anything that's going on, but if you cannot show the connection to learning, you're not going to have the credibility. This morning I had a conversation with an executive from a home improvement company here in Atlanta. He's going through this certification here on ROI, and he was telling me the CFO told him that, look, don't worry about store performance and connecting learning to that. We'll handle store performance. We're just going to make the assumption that learning doesn't drive store performance. He says, I'm not going to settle for that. I want to learn how to do that. They're spending a whole day today, 8 hours, learning how to isolate the effects of learning from other factors. That's one of our standards. All 3,500 people who become certified ROI professionals have to do that. They've done that. So we can do it credibly to pass the test of the CEO and CFO. So we'll look at those kinds of criteria that must be in your evaluation system to have it accepted so that we can use that data to drive in performance and look at learning as a value creator. And that's the theme of the conference. By the way, there's a lot of good speakers in the conference. Jim and I sharing the bookmarks, the opening, closing keynotes, but there are a lot of other sessions there. We invite anyone to come out. If you really want to know how to make learning add value, you won't see a collection of speakers and topics and issues any more richer than what you'll see there next week on Tuesday.
All right. And where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your work in the Institute?
You can go to roiinstitute.net. That gets to our website. Or send me an email, jack@roiinstitute.net. We'd be happy to deal with anything you have.
Well, thanks so much for coming down and visiting with us in the studio. We had a good time when we had a chance to do a brief interview when we were doing a remote broadcast at an event, but this is so much more fun and rewarding to have an in-depth conversation. And, hey, man, you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You going to hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Yes, I'm having another Bloody Mary event.
Fantastic. All right, next up on Learning Insights, we have with us from EBS Healthcare, I believe, Miss Melanie Hudson. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Did you learn anything in those last two segments?
I absolutely did. You can never learn enough about learning. And there are a lot of buzzwords that came up that overlap with some of the issues that I'm most concerned about with my background. Jim mentioned performance, and you mentioned closing gaps, and these are all areas that I focus on at a more granular level, actually, with individual performance. Coming from a clinical background with experience also in higher ed and education in general, and a little bit in hospitality, I had to develop individual training to improve individual performance. So it was more coaching and looking at areas that individuals needed to address to improve their individual performance to have value add to the organization as a whole. And one of my concerns also is employee engagement. If you don't have the individual performing at a level that they feel motivates them and that they feel contributes to the overall growth of the organization, the motivation is compromised. So I developed my own training module because there really wasn't anything out there that was based on adult learning theory. We all know adults learn very differently than children.
Is that true? Because I hear that a lot.
Do
adults really learn differently than children?
We do.
Like
in a better way or a worse way?
One thing people have to remember about adult learning is that when we are learning as adults, we already come to the table with a complete mindset about how we like to learn. And that's probably driven by how we've found through experience we learn best. And so we're always trying to fit our learning style into whatever is being taught. And many people don't know how to do that. Many instructors don't appreciate the fact that there are different learning styles. So we have preconceived notions about what's going to make us learn better. And so you get a buy-in either very quickly, or you say, this isn't for me, and you don't absorb it. And you were talking, Jim, earlier about YouTube. And the prediction is by 2016, 70% of all learning is going to be through that type of media. And
right, but the other 30% will be through his methodology.
Hopefully. Hopefully. If they're smart, yes. But what happens to the – well, that's assuming that 70% of people really do learn well that way, or even that is their best form of learning. But what about the other 30% who are not in that category? So I think that's an example of technology being the tail that wags the dog. And we need to be thinking along those lines when we talk about learning. And so I was a little frustrated with learning modules that are out there that, and especially trying to teach clinical skills to clinical supervisors and to the clinicians themselves when you don't take adult learning theory into account. But you also don't look at this as far as you're working in an organization, whether it be a hospital, a school, a clinic, it could be anywhere. You also need to be very engaged with the organization as a whole. It isn't just about helping this individual who has communication disorders. And what I would find is that you could have someone who's developed excellent clinical skills, but they don't want to stay at that organization or in that facility. Well, why is that? Where's the gap there in terms of their engagement with that facility? So they take their skills and their certificate and their license to practice, and they just go to yet another place. So I wanted to find a way that not only would help support the development of the clinical skills and knowledge for application purposes, but how that would connect to their engagement with the organization or with the facility where they were working. And this is something that in healthcare just is not there. You focus in healthcare as a clinical educator, I know this, we focus on teaching people the clinical skills and knowledge that they need to know to treat individuals with a disorder. And it's a very narrow focus. And what I found partially working in the hospitality industry, there's a whole culture of being involved or being engaged with and involved with the thinking that is institutional. It's not just your job at that moment in time that's part of your individual job description. It's being a part of a greater whole and where you can contribute.
To me, this goes back to some of the conversation we had earlier about measuring the right thing. So they probably were measuring clinical effectiveness, probably getting pretty high scores, leaving an entirely a very important dynamic off the table altogether.
Absolutely. Wondering why they weren't successful.
Was that because it's difficult to measure that? Or they were just choosing not to measure
because the way they're taught, clinical educators, by and large, teach just the clinical skills and knowledge. Mm.
And so that was what was important. So that's what they were focusing on. And then they were losing kind of sight about this engagement component.
Exactly.
And so you developed a methodology?
I did. It's a performance management system, I would call it, or a training tool. You can call it whatever you want to. But it's a core model. It's based on adult learning theory. And it's a cycle. I don't like to call it linear because you circle back. But it's a cycle. And CORE stands for collaboration, which is the first phase.
Right.
Observation, mm-hmm. reflection, and evaluation. So in collaboration, that's when you mentioned, Jim, you mentioned the trust that's so important there. That's when the trust is established with the coach, the mentor, the supervisor, the manager, whoever it is, with the employee. That's when you have to have the hook to get them engaged, and trust is very important. So the collaboration phase is when you establish that. You can talk about the job description. You can talk about the expectations, levels of performance that are going to be measured. But in this phase, to get that buy-in from the employee, you need to do some goal setting, and you need to foster the notion that this employee has a say and is, in fact, a stakeholder
in
their
whole
own
organization,
performance.
Though, right? Not
exactly.
Just, not just the one little task that
exactly.
may be charged to do, but how they fit into the bigger
Absolutely.
Puzzle, right? And a lot of times they don't know that.
Pay attention to this, Kevin. Are you listening to this?
They don't have a clue. So they look at the mission statement, perhaps, of the organization, the strategic plan.
Right. So they need a more macro view of the whole organization rather than a micro view of their one task.
Exactly. And then they need to use that as the driving force to where they're going to establish their own personal goals.
Mm-hmm. So what's the hardest part, though? Where do the wheels typically come off? Is collaboration harder?
No, collaboration is actually the fun part.
Yeah, so they enjoy
We're getting
that
to
part.
Know one another. That's sort
Back
of the honeymoon phase.
Marriage, right?
The honeymoon phase. And, you know, the conversation you have with the employee about, so where do you want to go? Where do you see yourself
right,
in
so
this company?
There's a lot of possibilities.
The sky's the limit
right
here.
Right.
Let's see what your plan is. Now let's see what we need to do in terms of goal setting to chart you on that course. Now, you may even be thinking, I don't think that's going to happen, but you know what? I never want to say never, but we're going to let them at least start down that path, and I would be, you know, delighted if they surprised me.
Right.
So that's the collaboration phase. The observation phase is where everything falls into place, and that's when the assessments are done. That's when you are able to observe. You take advantage of other people's observations of the employee's performance.
But is it a two-way street where the employee also is observing to make sure that the higher-ups are congruent
exactly.
with their promises, right? And they're
exactly.
keeping their word.
Oh, they're watching.
Like
they're already
right?
good at that,
exactly.
I guarantee you.
It's absolutely a two-way street, and that's part of what you establish in the goal-setting phase is how that works.
Yeah, I can imagine. These conversations, when you're trying to sell your thing into companies, they're not too thrilled about this part, right?
It depends on how you present it.
Are going to yell at me.
Yeah,
and I don't know if I like
that. But there's a way to do that. So yes, you get their buy-in as well. The next real critical piece is the reflection mm-hmm. part. And this is where individuals who have not been taught how to think critically have a little difficulty, but they embrace it as soon as they're taught. You know, we're not educating
children
to be critical thinkers.
So you think this is possible to teach, though?
Absolutely. Right. And critical thinking, it's like a duck to water. To actually ask someone, so how did you think that meeting went? You know, we're so ready to come in after we've done something, whether it be present a product or you know, do a business plan presentation to a group. Or when I taught a graduate course, I had my students do this activity after they presented their project to the class. Rather than my immediately giving them feedback, well, you know, I don't think that went too well, I don't say a word. I just say to them, so what did you think? Tell me about that. What needed to be in place for it to be successful? What would you do differently? And the first time you do this with them, they're a little taken aback. Sometimes the first response I will get is, well, isn't that your job as my evaluator to tell
what
me
do
what
you think?
And I say, well, I'm going to tell you. Right. But let's talk about this a little bit first. And what happens so many times is by the time they've gone through this process, they have already said some of the things that I would have said to them, but it's like a revelation to them. Gee, now that I think about it, maybe I should have done this.
So when they
don't have to say it then.
When they self-discovered, it's more powerful?
Absolutely more powerful.
And so you're just trying to facilitate the conversation that allows them to self-discover, you know, the pros and cons of whatever the task
That's
was.
That's exactly what happens. And I love to see that. Every time mm-hmm. I see that, it's like
now, do you have
something.
To kind of prompt them? And I'm sure there's skills from your standpoint on how to nudge them and to allow them to open up and to really share, because I'm sure a certain contingency will be just trying to guess what you want them to say, and you know they want to get it right rather than get
there
it
is, there is some right. of that sometimes.
So you
and
have
so,
to be able to facilitate that.
Yes, and there are key questions you can ask. And
what are some of those key questions? Just write these down. So I want
to. Well, actually, I'm going to be sharing that in my session.
Okay, good.
At the conference.
All right, so
there's
give
a
them
teaser
all away,
for
then.
You. That's right. That's right. You come to my session, we'll talk about
well,
that.
So let's say that we're working with Kevin. We're developing him as an executive. He has a great deal of promise, and he could be
I
running regions and studios and things like that. So I take your counsel, and I ask Kevin, well, how do you think that went? And he starts to get better and better at self-reflecting. But he's missing one thing I really do need to call his attention to. I could probably get better at that, too. are there some rules of the road where I can provide constructive feedback, provide some genuine value, but not step on the guy and crush
yes.
his spirit?
And that's the E for core. That's the evaluation process. Now, self-evaluation is the most effective learning tool. When people feel that they have a part in the assessment process. Mm-hmm. First of all, the assessment tool that's going to be used should never be a surprise. They should know from the very first stage how they're being evaluated, what they're being evaluated on, what type of tool is going to be used. So you, as you said, Jim, Jack, you've got the end in sight. So that is not just achieving the goal, but how are you going to be measured in terms of whether or not you've achieved the goal. So the end is in sight. But one of the things that I always cover in this training that I do on this model is how to have those conversations. I call them courageous conversations that won't devastate the person and make them feel like they want to go and work for another radio station or maybe go out of the mm-hmm. profession entirely. Maybe I need to go and become a dentist or something entirely different because you've just shattered his entire thinking about what he wanted to do with his life. So one of the things to remember is that a conversation of this type needs to be motivating. And the way you motivate them, I'll be covering that as well in the session, but one of the things I always make sure I tell people is that you need to spend more time preparing for this conversation than you do in actually having the conversation. The preparation is huge. And because you know you're going to have this conversation with this individual, you have time to prepare. There's no reason for you not to be able to take that time. And there are some specific strategies that you use to have these conversations. And if you do it effectively, when the person leaves, they actually feel motivated and excited, and they've got a plan, and you do come out of there with a plan, because now you're going back in the cycle
so
to
that's
the collaboration
key.
You
come
phase.
Out of it with a plan.
You
not
come
just
out with
dialogue.
A plan.
So there has to be
and
next
so,
steps.
Right. And next steps is going back to the collaboration phase. Let's look at this goal
right.
and tweak it a little. Or we may need to add this goal. this is a whole new area that we need to address. Let's write a goal for this, and let's see how we can get there. So you're
so
coming away
cycle.
From there.
It's not like correct. A 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's a
it
cycle.
It kind of goes in a circle. Now, what if they, you know, say, yeah, that sounds good, and then we do this, and then, again, they're not compliant or they're not achieving this goal. Like, how many times do we do this cycle?
As many times as it takes.
Forever?
As many times as it takes to achieve. Because in leadership development, for example, this can be something that goes for your whole career. Mm-hmm. This isn't a one-time thing. But the other purpose that it could be used is for specific gap, filling in those gaps.
Right.
This individual really needs to work on this. This is going to be a short-term fix to address that. So this can be applied as a crisis management type of situation,
right.
or as a, in 10 years, I want to be here.
Right.
Let's
and
come
then,
up with a plan.
So you just slowly work them into that,
exactly.
those skills and into that
yes.
role.
So Jack and Jim were both making some notes while you were talking. So with your permission, I'd like to bring them into the conversation. And we'll start with Jack. Can you weigh in on some of this
yeah.
a little bit?
Well, I certainly agree with the concept. And it's, I think it's powerful learning. You make some good points. It's really what people do with what they've learned that's the critical part, and it's the application and impact. And that impact that you're looking for many times is the engagement. Job engagement is probably one of the most important measures that are out there. And you mentioned the e-learning. I just want to weigh in on this issue. One of the problems we see with e-learning, and Jim may confirm that, is that e-learning may deliver level 1 and 2, and that's reaction and learning, but it falls short on application and impact. And that's a challenge for the developers of e-learning. That is, you don't get the behavior change or the application, the action to do things from the electronic approach so much. And you don't have, and correspondingly, you don't have the impact. So we work with e-learning developers on this issue to try to get them to put more application tools in there, put more prompts to get and enablers to make them use what they've learned. Otherwise, we keep converting to technology, and we're going to find out it's not working there. And finally, healthcare, I think I'd applaud your efforts in healthcare. It's such a huge issue. We need a lot of good help in that area. So much so we wrote a book just published. It's called Measuring ROI in Healthcare. I'm going to send you a copy of it.
Oh, great. Okay. That would be wonderful.
That's
Thank
pushing
you.
It right up to the
Thank
next level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How about that? We scored you a free book.
Yes,
how are we doing?
We did. I love that.
Now, is it true that I've heard this said that people don't quit jobs, they quit bosses? Is that part of this engagement challenge that
Kevin's looking at me.
Yes. One of the three key factors in employee engagement is the relationship with your direct supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
So your boss. It doesn't necessarily have to be the CEO that
right.
you never even see.
Right.
But one of the three keys in employee engagement is the relationship you have with a supervisor. The company can be great. You love everything else about it. But that personal relationship has been compromised in some way or never was a positive one.
Yes. And we've got a lot of research that supports that. That mm-hmm. People are attracted to organizations but leave their boss. And
yep.
a lot of research shows that. We documented that in our book, Managing Talent Retention. We'll send you a copy of that.
There, man, you're just giving out books left and right now.
Now, Jim, you were just being polite, or did you actually write down some notes and you had something to say on some of this?
This is just a to-do list of things that I need to do
the
later.
Grocery list.
No,
grapes, milk, bread, right.
Yeah, make sure you bring the milk. No, actually, Melanie, it was just a joy to hear your spirit. And what I really like is I could listen and very comfortably picture this happening, not just with senior learning leaders, but this is something that is, I think, it's powerful, but it's simple enough that you could use this for a lot of people.
Yes.
Rather than trying to push some complex model through that just is not going to be practical for people that are not full-time into what you're talking about. So I really love that. And the other thing I love is you're talking about the package. You're talking about the coaching that you're working on. You're talking about motivated and exciting employees that are going through this because that's what's going to keep them going.
Right.
You talk about additional learning. And just a plug for our ROE approach, one of the unique features is we help to determine the relative contribution of each of those components rather than trying to look at any one by itself and believing that the package is the power, and we want credit where credit is due. And right. we don't want, for instance, that educated person to be excluded from some kind of determination of value. We want to make sure that what they do counts just as much as the learning and the training that we develop. So that's
exactly.
just something that we strongly believe in.
Not just people with valuable skills, but valuable skills.
Keep going. You're
almost there.
Yeah. Well, people with valuable skills and not valuable skills that people have.
Right.
So how about that? Scored you a free book and endorsement from two of the most recognized leaders in the arena. We're doing pretty good.
We can stop right now.
Well, actually, we're going to, but you can come back anytime you like. But let's make sure that our listeners know how to reach out and learn more about CORE and your work.
Well, I need to write my own book on CORE. It has been published in the context of a chapter on clinical supervision and mentoring in a professional issues book in speech, language, pathology, and audiology, the fourth edition. So it's kind of buried out there in the clinical world, but so I am working on a book on that by itself. Sure. and present it all over. I mean, I go to universities and conferences and present this a lot, so people have, you know, they have the presentation, they just don't have it in a book form. So I'm going to do that.
That's a goal.
Exactly. Need to do that. And website is under construction, but my email, and I love to have personal communication with individuals. It's Melanie Hudson, SLP, as in speech language pathologist, because that's what I do, @comcast.net.
Fantastic. I always love visiting with learning professionals. There's so much passion.
Right, and it's so collaborative.
It is, yeah. You guys, there's plenty of room for everybody. There's plenty to be done, and it's such a collaborative bunch, and it really has been an absolute delight having all three of you in the studio, and the offer is quite sincere. We are, we would just be thrilled to death to have all of you back sometime. Come back with a client or someone that you collaborate with.
That's a great idea.
And then talk about how you guys work together and how you really can move the needle in an organization.
That would be a lot of fun. Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor, our sponsors, Training Pros, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next week on Learning Insights.